It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good Monday morning, everyone. And we begin the week with more dramatic developments in the saga of America in the time of the Trump administration. This time, breaking news on the woman accusing Brett Kavanaugh of sexual assault from their high school days. Christine Blasey Ford, now a 51-year-old research psychologist, went public with her identity just yesterday. And just this morning, her lawyer, Lisa Banks, said on NPR's Morning Edition that Ford would be willing to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee.
She will agree to participate in any proceedings that she's asked to participate in. Her goal has been and is that this information be provided to the people making the decision so that those making a very important decision can make an informed decision with all the facts.
For Kavanaugh's part, as you probably heard, he has categorically denied the allegation, as has his high school friend, the other boy at the time, who Professor Ford mentions as also being involved. Ford took and passed a lie detector test about the allegation this summer and reportedly told her husband and a therapist about the alleged incident years ago. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand put out a statement last night saying in part, "I believe her and I will stand by her. She must not be attacked and smeared. The Senate needs to pause and investigate this allegation in a bipartisan manner." Unquote, that from Senator Gillibrand. Senator Lisa Murkowski and Senator Jeff Flake, two key Republican potential swing votes, also indicated they want to know more. Then there's the development that broke after our show on Friday of Paul Manafort accepting a plea deal and cooperation agreement with special counsel Robert Mueller. Here is Congressman Adam Schiff, ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, explaining how Manafort could be a threat to Trump on Meet the Press.
Manafort is at the confluence of a number of pernicious interests. You've got the president's son trying to get dirt from the Russians in Trump Tower. You've got the president himself asking the Russians for dirt on Hillary Clinton in a public statement. You've got Manafort trying to get money from this Russian oligarch, trying to get made whole. You have the Russians who want to have a relationship with the Trump campaign. They want to help Trump get elected. All those interests converge with Paul Manafort. So basically, we want to know what can Manafort tell us about whether any of that was consummated. He's trying to get money. They're trying to get dirt. The Russians are trying to help Trump. Was there a meeting of the minds? So that goes to the heart of the collusion or conspiracy issue.
Adam Schiff on Meet the Press. And it also got revealed over the weekend that Manafort and Trump had a joint defense agreement. That would be dissolved now, with Manafort pleading guilty and cooperating with Mueller. We'll talk later in the show to our legal analyst, Jamie Floyd, about what a joint defense agreement between Manafort, who was charged with something, and Trump, who hasn't been, even meant. But both the Kavanaugh and Manafort developments, besides in and of themselves, could have implications for the midterm elections and who controls the House and Senate next year. So with me now is Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Thanks for doing this, Susan. Nothing much to talk about. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's great to be back.
The Christine Ford story is moving pretty quickly at the moment. Was her lawyer's statement about her willingness to testify the latest development as far as you know?
Yes. We do have two Republican senators saying there should be a delay in the vote, Senator Flake and Senator Corker. Flake is particularly important because he's a member of the Judiciary Committee. And we do have the sense that this the disclosure that there was an accuser was an important development, but the disclosure, the affirmation today that she is willing to testify under oath before the committee takes us to a whole new level, makes it impossible for Republicans to ignore it.
The Senate Judiciary Committee was supposed to vote on Kavanaugh this Thursday. Is that still on as of now?
It's still on as of now, but it seems to me unlikely that that's going to happen. I just think, you need to have, I think it is likely that the Judiciary Committee will take her up on her offer to testify under oath before them, and then we'll see where we stand. So I think that it's still, I guess, conceivable they would move ahead with a vote on Thursday. But if they do so, they're likely to lose in committee because I think it's now every Democrat would vote against moving ahead, and they would be joined by Senator Flake. And that means that Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader of the Senate, would be faced with the unhelpful situation of having to take this out of committee without a favorable vote to the floor of the Senate. That seems unlikely.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you think there will be significant Republican resistance to even holding a public hearing, reopening the confirmation hearings, and allowing Professor Ford to testify under oath. I read part of the statement from Senator Gillibrand saying she believes Professor Ford. Ford must not be smeared, and the confirmation vote should be delayed. Here, by contrast, is Republican Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina.
That information never came up, so when we get back to Washington this week, we'll take a look at it. But it really raises a question in my mind about if this was material to the confirmation process, why on earth over the past 4 to 6 weeks hasn't it been discussed among the committee members?
So he did tuck in there, when we come back to Washington this week, this will be heard. And then he expressed his skepticism. It's fair for him to express skepticism, but do you think this is going to translate to Tillis or anybody else trying not to have a hearing?
Well, let me just ask you, was that Tom Tillis speaking on Face the Nation on CBS yesterday?
I believe that it was.
Right. So that was before we knew that she was willing to come forward with her name. At that point, she was still anonymous. We didn't know what her name was. We didn't know if she was going to be willing to speak publicly. We didn't know if she was willing to testify under oath. That changes things. And I wonder if you spoke to Senator Tillis today, if he would have a somewhat different tone. I think it is difficult for senators to refuse to hear her. Now, they may hear her and decide they don't believe her, but I think it is very likely we're going to have a hearing.
I see. Listeners, our phones are open on the Christine Ford allegations and on the Paul Manafort plea and its implications. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Your thoughts and anything you want to ask Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Remind us of some of the history of this allegation. As Tillis suggests, and especially for listeners who really weren't paying much attention until maybe the last day on this, Professor Ford had notified Senator Dianne Feinstein about this months ago, correct?
Yes, in July this summer, she informed her local member of Congress. Senator Feinstein also was informed about it. Senator Feinstein had a conversation with her. But it is making an anonymous allegation, particularly one that goes back 36 years or so, is tough. And she didn't want to be public. And it was only after her name began to leak and reporters began to contact her that she decided that she would step forward with her name, be willing to testify. So, yes, it is accurate to say that some Democrats were aware of this some time ago, but it's tough. It's one of those difficult situations if you have an accusation without a name attached to it.
And why didn't Senator Feinstein bring it to her colleagues, if I understand correctly, that even in closed session of the Judiciary Committee, she did not. Is that accurate?
Well, I think we'll know more about this in the next day or two because we're going to be examining it closely. There was at some point a redacted letter that was available to all the members of the committee. But I think that I don't think that was as early as July. I think that was later. And I know that Senator Durbin, I saw him being interviewed this morning, and he said he found out about this only about 9 days ago. So I think Senator Feinstein has said that she was concerned about protecting the anonymity of the woman at the point that's what she wanted. That's when Christine Ford wanted that. And as I said, I think it just changes everything to have a woman of standing, a professor, make an accusation as serious as this, even though it does date back to their teenage years.
What was this lie detector test?
So her lawyer says that she took a lie detector, and the Washington Post says this morning that she took a lie detector test this summer and passed it, that she was speaking truthfully. That goes to building her credibility. So does releasing the notes from a therapist that she was seeing and when she talked about the trauma that she felt after this attack.
I'm still trying to put all the pieces together, as I guess everybody is. But she took a lie detector test about this incident at a time when she was not intending to go public with it, and Senator Feinstein was not pushing it as an issue with respect to Brett Kavanaugh's fitness?
You know, I think this is more than we know at this moment. And I think this is something we're going to find out about in the next day or two or three. She may have been, and I'm speculating here, considering whether she would be believed if she came forward, because that's one of the difficult calculations that mm-hmm. we know women have made in bringing right. allegations of sexual harassment in the past. Just talk to Anita Hill.
So she probably, Professor Ford, probably had a tortured summer deciding whether or not she should take the next step in going forward and revealing her identity, and was preparing for the eventuality that she might decide to do that, or, as you suggested a few minutes ago, others might have outed her in the press, and she was preparing for that kind of possibility?
Well, I think that's entirely likely, although I'd like to hear that from her as opposed to just speculating about it. But yeah. we know from these, what's the lesson of the Me Too movement of recent months? It's that's now just about a year old. I think the anniversary where usually date the Me Too movement is in October. The lesson is you pay a price when you come forward, but that women increasingly are believed. Their accusations are taken seriously in a way that they weren't in the past.
Funny enough, Vice President Pence had just offered to take a lie detector test to help prove he didn't write the anonymous New York Times op-ed saying Trump was being managed by adults in the White House room. Would they volunteer Kavanaugh to take a lie detector test to match Professor Ford's?
You know, I don't think it'll come to that. I mean, I think his nomination is now in some peril. I think it will take, I think we just have to see how this unfolds. There is already talk in Republican circles about whether he'll be forced to withdraw his name. It seems unlikely they would get to the point where he would also be taking a lie detector test.
I've also heard at least two competing scenarios of how this could affect the midterm elections. One is that Democratic and independent women are already so enraged at the Republicans in the Trump and the Me Too era that if Republican senators don't take these sexual assault charges seriously, Republicans could lose the Senate, not just the House. The other is that if the Kavanaugh confirmation does get delayed until after the election, as Democrats want, or if he gets pulled altogether and somebody else, you know, has to be nominated, and so that Supreme Court seat is not yet filled, that many base Republicans who make the Supreme Court such a central voting issue and who the current projections show might stay home in droves could get more energized and turn out more, and that would help Republicans. Do you have any take on either of those scenarios or maybe your own?
I'm usually happy to speculate, but you have to get like six steps down the road to figure out what the political impact of this is going to be on the midterms in 50 days. I think we just have to see what happens, even this week, before we have a sense of that. It is true. Here's what we know. We know that Republican voters have been very energized by the Supreme Court nomination, right? This has been a more powerful issue for Republicans and Democrats. It's important to Republicans. They're now on the verge to solidifying a new conservative majority on the Supreme Court. So it's a big issue for Republicans. And we know that the Me Too movement and the treatment of women is a huge issue for Democrats. So this has the potential to have some political repercussions in the midterms. But I think we've got to wait and see what happens before we figure out what that will be.
Just on Republican turnout for the midterm elections, they were talking on Morning Joe today on MSNBC about a focus group that included base Republican voters, real Trump supporters, and many of them did not believe, they said, the idea that a blue wave is coming. And, you know, they considered it fake news because they didn't trust the pollsters and the media. And therefore, they didn't feel so motivated like they needed to turn out and stop this fake blue wave.
So it's kind of an irony there that Trump's base believes him when he talks about fake news, and therefore they don't take seriously the idea that Republicans are in some real trouble in the midterms. But they are. You know, I think the standard calculation now by both Democratic and Republican strategists is that if the vote were today, Republicans would lose the House of Representatives. And if they lost the House, that would open the door not just to impeachment. It would open the door to impeachment. There'd be a lot of pressure from Democratic base voters to consider that. It would open the door to investigations about a dozen other things with this administration that have happened in the White House or in various agencies. It would be a different world for Donald Trump in Washington if they lost the House, much less the Senate, even more serious if the Senate flipped. The Senate is tough for Democrats this year because of the seats that happen to be out, up, the number of Democratic incumbents who are up in states that Trump won. But it is no longer inconceivable that Democrats take the Senate as well.
I'm going to jump in with a little bit of breaking local news right now. The FDNY says it's responding to a massive 6-alarm fire at the parking garage at Brooklyn's Kings Plaza Shopping Center. Videos of the area show a large cloud of dark smoke rising from the site. Officials say they received the call shortly after 8 o'clock this morning. Emergency workers are treating people at the scene, but no one has been transported to a hospital at this point. The WNYC newsroom is following this, and Richard Hake will have the latest coming up in our newscast later this hour. But just letting you know, especially if you need to use that area or know people who work there or whatever, the FDNY says it's responding to a massive 6-alarm fire in the parking garage at Brooklyn's Kings Plaza Shopping Center. We continue with Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, and Ann in Park Slope. You're on WNYC. Ann, thank you for calling.
Hey, Brian, thanks for taking my call. Good morning. How you doing?
Good morning. All right.
I've been following this story since the Dianne Feinstein information came out in The Intercept last week. I've been very, very struck by the attempt, the sort of inadvertent attempt to blunt the conversation on this by many people by just saying this was a childhood incident, that this incident goes back 35 years. And I am very struck by the fact that that is the first response to so many people in the media and so many people that I speak to, rather than actually taking a good look at the graphic nature of this incident that took place with Brett Kavanaugh. And I just find that this attempt to sort of blunt this conversation makes me wonder, what would you do if your 17-year-old son did this to a 15-year-old girl? What would you do if your 53-year-old husband, who coaches your daughter's basketball team, is suddenly being accused of doing this when he was a 17-year-old man? I find that aspect of this really dangerous, and I hope that this is not something that just gets shrugged off, because what he did was the act of a very informed, soon-to-be adult, about to go to Yale, young man.
And at a very prestigious Georgetown prep school.
Exactly.
So he certainly was growing up as someone of privilege when this alleged incident took place. And stay there for a second. I'll just read a line to your point in the Washington Post report on Sunday. It included Ford alleging that Kavanaugh, quote, pinned her to a bed on her back and groped her over her clothes, grinding his body against hers while trying to remove her clothes. When she tried to scream, she said, he put his hand over her mouth. And then the article goes on, but ultimately she was able to run from the room, according to her description to the Washington Post. So, Ann, how would you answer the critics who you're addressing? That is, and it may very well come to this, even though Kavanaugh denies that this ever happened, but let's say people come to believe that this did actually happen. What is the relevance to someone's fitness to serve on the Supreme Court today if this happened 35 years ago when he was in high school?
I would say that this was a 17-year-old man who entrapped a 15-year-old girl And if he wasn't so drunk, which is also very important to me, because I'm also seeing emails alluding to his drunken parties, whatever, I would say if he wasn't so drunk, he would have raped her. And when a 17-year-old rapes someone, is that the act of a child, or is that an indicator of who that person already is and how that is going to imprint who he becomes? Mm-hmm.
And thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate it. And Susan Page, I guess there's a fair likelihood that what we just heard and responses to it are going to be the national conversation in a few days from now.
Yes, I think it will be. And these questions are big ones. It doesn't matter that he was a teenager at the time. What exactly happened? Is there evidence? Who do we end up believing? If at the moment she says one thing and he denies it flatly, and the other young man who was in the room says he doesn't remember this incident, which is not exactly a denial. It's something short of a denial. Mm-hmm. I think that we'll have a chance to see all that. And there's also a question about what is the standard for a Supreme Court justice? You know, our debate is not should we prosecute Brett Kavanaugh for a crime. It's should we confirm him for the Supreme Court? And one of the points that some Democrats are making this morning is that the case of Al Franken, who was accused of groping women and forced to resign from the Senate by his colleagues. You know, some of these Republican senators called on him to resign because that was behavior that was unacceptable in a U.S. senator. Well, there is, you know, a U.S. senator is elected by people for a 6-year term. A Supreme Court justice is confirmed for life.
Yeah, and this just in, Kavanaugh calls the accusation, quote, completely false. Now, he had denied it over the weekend, so he's out with another denial, completely false, and says he will, quote, refute the allegation before the Senate Judiciary Panel. So I guess that also kind of indicates, besides the fact that he's denying it, that he anticipates having to testify about it under oath now.
That's right, and it also indicates that at least at this point he plans to stay and fight and not withdraw
right.
his name.
Hector in Union City, you're on WNYC. Hi, Hector.
Hey, good morning, Brian and Ann. I'm curious, if this moves forward and he is forced to step or withdraw his name for nomination, how will that affect his current seat? Because I believe he sits on a district court of appeals, correct?
Right, he sits on a very high court of appeals just below the Supreme Court level in D.C. Susan, and it's not Ann was our previous caller. I'm glad you said hello to her, Hector. But our guest is Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. That's an interesting question. Would it have any implications for his current seat?
Well, Hector, that's a good question. And, of course, I'm not a lawyer, but I don't believe so. I don't think it automatically would do anything about his lifetime appointment in confirmation to the Court of Appeals. Now, sometimes there's a political story that unfolds that's different, but it seems to me I don't believe there's any reason why that would automatically disqualify him for the seat he now holds. If he withdrew his name, which, again, it doesn't sound like he's going to do, we just heard a denial from him that indicates he's going to stay and fight. But if he withdrew, it would be to give the president the opportunity to name another justice, to avoid a big fight over this. It wouldn't necessarily be because he would admit any wrongdoing.
All right. Well, obviously, this is a developing story, and we'll stay on it today. We'll talk more about some of the legal as well as political aspects of it with our legal analyst, Jamie Floyd, coming up in about a half hour with Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. In our remaining few minutes, I want to go on to the Manafort plea briefly. Why now?
I think why now? Because Paul Manafort had been convicted on a couple counts in his first trial. He was facing a second trial. His future looks pretty dire at his age. The prison sentence he's facing is, in effect, a life in prison sentence. And he finally folded. He did what he said he wasn't interested in doing. He made a deal with the special counsel. He's agreed to answer all their questions, to meet with them without a lawyer present, to turn over all the documents he has. So this is a truly, really consequential development for the special counsel.
Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani released a statement over the weekend saying Manafort's cooperation would have nothing to do with Trump, But here is Harvard, you're laughing, and apparently so was Harvard Law Professor Alan Dershowitz, a frequent defender of Trump, on Meet the Press yesterday.
What I don't understand is how you can say that the deal is limited. The deal, as I understand it, says that Manafort will cooperate about anything that the special counsel asks him about. There are no limits. This wasn't a deal that says we're going to talk only about so-and-so, but we're not going to talk about the Trump or the Trump Tower meeting. Obviously, one of the first questions they're going to ask him is, did Donald Trump's son know about the subject of the meeting before it occurred, right, in order to put pressure on Trump Jr., in order to put pressure on President Trump. So, look, I understand why Rudy Giuliani, who's a good lawyer, wants to put this in the most positive light, but this was a very bad day for the Trump administration. It's bad because he doesn't know what Manafort is saying, and he can't count on Manafort saying only things that the special counsel already knows. And when you don't know what a cooperator is saying, then it's a bad day for you because you're vulnerable and exposed.
Alan Dershowitz on Meet the Press yesterday, frankifying the name Manafort, calling him Manafort, as for some reason he always does, with a silent T. But Susan Page, what happens next and how quickly?
Well, that's a good question, and another question that we don't know the answer to because the special counsel doesn't tell us very much. When they speak, they speak almost entirely in a courtroom by indicting people or convicting them. But we do have a general sense that the special counsel seems to be moving toward a conclusion, at least on the most important, what I think many of us think is the most important part of their investigation, which was there collusion by the Trump campaign with Russian interference, and did the president obstruct justice? And on that first question, no one was more at the center of things at the point that collusion would have taken place, if it did, than Paul Manafort.
Since you're Washington Bureau Chief of USA Today, I'll note that a USA Today article on Manafort goes into what a rough and tumble player he was, including, if I understood it correctly, now that these things are coming to the fore, fabricating charges of anti-Semitism against one president of Ukraine to benefit his pro-Russia other president of Ukraine client.
Yes. Well, Paul Manafort has been a strategist, a lobbyist in town for a very long time, a former partner of Roger Stone, who is who's also a central figure in the special counsel's investigation. You know, the Manafort deal may well be bad news for President Trump and for Donald Trump Jr., and it is almost certainly also bad news for Roger Stone, who seems to be a target of the investigation. So Paul Manafort has been has played hardball for some time, and now he is required. He has agreed in court and is now required to answer, to tell the special counsel everything he knows.
I haven't heard of someone fabricating charges of anti-Semitism against a political rival since, it was Andrew Cuomo last week. But that's another show. In fact, it's related to the show that we're going to do next, because we're going to talk about what comes next after the New York primary last week, many ramifications of that. So that's coming up in a minute. And for now, we thank Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief of USA Today. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.